This business podcast is brought to you in association with GapPropertyInvestments.com. Hello, and you're very welcome to another edition of the Breadwinners Podcast. It is episode 8. Yeah, where did that time go? This business podcast, it looks into the lives of current entrepreneurs and business owners and how they've navigated their way to being the best they can be and what makes them tick. I'm going to look into their highs and their lows of their journey and what helpful tips they can give. This week on the podcast is Gavin Galler, who is a property investor and developer and also is a director of the Earlsfort Group that owns the prestigious East Point Estate in Dublin. Gavin's story has had many ups and downs along the way and is motivated to share these experiences with others in the hope he can elevate their game, shape their investing habits, and help avoid some of the mistakes he made. Gavin currently writes, speaks, and mentors on the topic of mindset and resilience in real estate. He's also fascinated by technology and innovation and how it's transforming the real estate industry. Let's get into episode 8 of the Breadwinners Podcast. Gavin, you're very welcome to the Breadwinners Podcast. Thanks for taking time out of your day and having a chat with us. How are you?
Very good, thanks, Pork. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to get you on the Breadwinners Podcast. It's great to get someone who's out there doing it and in the cold face of it at the minute. Business is challenging for everyone across the world. How's Gavin Galler and co been getting over the stringencies that COVID-19 is?
It is challenging for sure. I run a business park in the city centre in Dublin, and we have quite a lot of tenants that normally there'd be kind of a couple of thousand people working in the place. And at the moment, I'd say we're down to maybe 1% of the usual numbers. So it's very, very low. And we have it's a lot of big multinational companies. So they've all got these very, very strict policies about the dates they'll come back. And so I'm inundated with questions about all of the different services we provide and how we're going to provide them safety and things of that nature. So it's a challenging time for sure, you know.
Obviously the challenges are coming, and dealing with those challenges, Gavin, is it something that you thrive on?
Well, I think one of the things that I was kind of taught some lessons, if you go back to 2008, I kind of came down pretty hard in the 2008 recession, and that was a real difficult period of time. And, you know, you either sank or you swam, and I developed a couple of, I guess, mindset tricks, and I just managed to kind of keep my head kind of in a positive place. So no matter what, whether it's up or down, I try to keep kind of a level head, because if things are going great, you can kind of go off the wall a bit as well, you know? So I think it's important to kind of keep some perspective on what's possible out there, you know?
And as the old business saying goes, sometimes when there is challenges, there's also opportunity. Is this something that you see at the minute as well?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it all depends on how you're, I suppose, positioned going into this crisis. A lot of people, if they thought that things were not going to stop, I mean, if the party was going to keep going on and everything was going growing, you might find yourself in a difficult spot now, because maybe you've, you know, overstretched on the borrowings and things like that. So you do have to obviously weigh up where you are in the position. But I think anyone who was being cautious and saving up some cash and things like that, I think there's going to be a buying opportunity, but I think it'll be another 6 months away or something, because I think from my previous experience in 2008, you know, the economy stops, but the property market doesn't really react straight away. It's usually a bit of a lag behind. So 6 to 12 months, that's when you'll start to see prices impacted in the property side.
Let's get more into your day-to-day, what you do, Gavin. And suppose we touched a little bit on it there, but it's real estate in a massive deal. Yeah. So maybe we'll talk a wee bit about that first. Tell us, how did you get into it? Well, that's the first question.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about some of the questions you sent me, and I was saying, okay, so getting into property, in my case, I was kind of born into it, because my dad and my grandfather were both in the house building business. And so, you know, I grew up around building sites and, you know, visiting building sites with my dad on the weekends and things like that. So for me, ever since I was a young lad, I've been kind of hanging around scaffolding and builders and concrete blocks and all of that. That was kind of, you know, normal for me. So I kind of think it was always going to be the case that I was going to end up in it. I never really thought of anything else. I mean, except for computers. When computers came along, I was mad into all that stuff as a teenager. So that's where the property and the technology innovation and stuff that my interest comes from, I guess. And what happened was I studied architecture and I went off to America with my parents on a family holiday back in 1987 or something like that. And we ended up in New York City, and I can remember the experience of arriving in New York City and seeing these skyscrapers where you have to crane your head up, you know, kind of to see the top floors. It was really, really impressive. And I just came back from America with this fixation with becoming an architect. And my dad was delighted because he had not gone to college. His grandfather, his father had not gone to college. And so, you know, the fact that maybe I was going to go off to college and become an architect, that was something that he was kind of proud of. So I went down that path and became an architect and started working with a big firm called Scott Town & Walker. And Scott Town & Walker was Scott Town & Walker was great, but I kind of tired of it pretty quick. And I guess there's a kind of an entrepreneurial streak that runs through me. And in terms of like jobs when I was a teenager, I had, when I was in school, I had a fake ID business. And so I actually, I was quite good at drawing and I was quite good at, you know, producing kind of documents with line. Everything was straight and the lettering was perfect. And I was able to produce an ID for this fictitious college in Rathmines that I came up with. And I was selling these IDs for €10 or £10 at the time each. And so this was a little bit, my first little business. And it was quite popular. There was a lot of different schools that used to come to get my IDs and stuff. And so that was kind of my first taste of business. And it was the only one that I did that was slightly on the wrong side of the law, if you want to. But and then when I started college, I started a little car valeting business. And I can remember one of my friends was working in a bar. And he was saying, oh, it's great to have the job, you know, in the evenings to make the extra few euro. And I can remember sort of saying to him, I must give that a go myself. And I went off and I worked in a bar for the night. And I remember I had the next morning, my legs were tired. I'd spent hours on my feet running around chasing all these people. And I made less than half of what I would make washing a car. And I remember thinking to myself, I've been washing cars for my dad and for my mom and all this kind of stuff. And I do a good job and I check the prices and it was about twice what you make for a night working in a bar. So I started a car valeting business and I ended up making 60 or 90 pounds a day. If I would do three cars, I would get £90. And I can remember thinking like, why would I work? So I was always looking for something that paid more value than what I was currently working at. And that was kind of there all along. So when I started working as an architect, this same kind of thought came back very quickly. And I went out on my own to start my own business as an architect. And I got a small job working for a couple. I got a small sort of, you know, client, and they wanted a domestic house extension in Ranelagh. And there was, it was a small job. It wasn't very exciting, but it was my first job as my own boss. And I kind of thought, this is great. And I poured all my kind of attention and love and attention into it. And what actually happened was during that time, I remember I heard about a plot of land in Sligo that was for sale. And it was very cheap, but it was in an area that I knew because my family are for that part of the world. And I think it was £25,000 to buy it. And it was for an acre of land on the main street in Enniscrone. And I bought this plot of land, and I decided, I'm an architect, I can go and I can get planning permission all by myself. So I went off and got planning permission. So I was running the house domestic project in Ranelagh, and this project was going on for 9 months. And I was doing this little house project, you know, getting the planning permission. And this took around about the same length of time with the planning process and all that. And I can remember I worked day and night on the Ranelagh project. And at the end of 9 months of working, you know, hours and hours and hours every week on this small domestic house project as an architect, I earned £8,000. And the 25,000 that I invested in this house, and I had put maybe 1 week of work into the planning permission and all that. And I decided, okay, I'll see if what I can get, if I can sell the plot of land. And a builder, a local builder, came along and said, I'll buy it from you. And he offered me $125,000 for it. And I can remember thinking, what? I remember thinking, this is unbelievable. This is like, I've done a week's work and I've made $100,000. And over here, I did 9 months of slog for $8,000. And that was the moment when I decided, okay, property business is where I'm going. And I gave up architecture pretty much at that point. And I closed up my little business and I just decided to focus on real estate full time.
And that experience, of starting out so young and seeing your father, obviously, and from what you told me through your passage of conversation there, you actually carried blocks and bricks and bags of cement as well. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, but my dad died very young. And when I was in college, he actually died. He was only 45 years of age. And so that kind of threw a spanner in. The plan was, you know, to spend a couple of years in college having fun. And suddenly my dad died and there was no succession plan or anything like that. He was kind of he'd been a house builder and then he had gotten into property himself and he had gotten into angel investing and he had made investments in various companies. And suddenly he's gone and I had to kind of step in and sort of take over the running of the business. And I was helping my mom out with that because I was still studying in college at the time. So it was, I mean, there was less work on the building site and more just thrown into the deep end in terms of business. And I started having to attend board meetings at a very young age. And I mean, I knew nothing about all that kind of stuff when I started. And so it was a kind of baptism of fire. And I made a lot of mistakes. But I guess that's how you learn. If my dad had lived, he obviously would have mentored me and I would have had the benefit of him advising me along the way so I didn't have to make the mistakes. But I guess, you know, you can't look back. You just have to kind of look forward, you know.
He obviously did a good enough job with you anyway from the limited time he had. But what age were you when you were thrown into the deep end?
I was 21 when he died. In fact, the day he got sick, he went to Africa on business and he got very, very ill when he was in Africa and they didn't have hospital facilities to treat him. So he came back to Ireland in a terrible state with organ failure and all sorts of things. And that all started on the day of my 21st birthday. But he didn't want to ruin my birthday. So he didn't actually call us and tell us that this was happening at the time. So the next day I found out that he was in such a serious condition. And so that was the beginning of it all and literally the day of my 21st birthday.
Tell me about some of the stages that, suppose when you got into that level of business, some huge decisions, obviously, you had to make at such a young age. Can you reflect back on that for me?
Well, I mean, it's a lot of it. I mean, I have to give a lot of credit to my mother because she shouldered the burden for a couple of years because she did not want me to quit architecture. I mean, I was just starting. I was in the middle of third year when this all happened. And I had to finish third year and then two more years to actually qualify. And she was determined because Dad was so proud of me getting into college in the first place, that she was determined that I was going to actually qualify and become an architect. So she didn't want me to shoulder the burden of the business immediately. And because I could have done that, and but to do that, I would have had to abandon the degree. And so I was kind of, she was carrying a lot of the, shouldering a lot of the load, and I was kind of coming in and trying to kind of help out as well. But it was a difficult time because she was, she was very, very new to business. She had never been involved in any decision-making with Dad and stuff. And so she was thrown in, as much as I was, she was thrown in the deep end. And she suffered from a lot of anxiety from some of the decisions, because my dad had been a big risk taker. And he had, the day he died, he had a number of projects kind of in the middle of development and stuff. And she didn't know a lot of this detail. And suddenly, you know, after he had died, we started opening posts and seeing that he owed millions of euro here and there. And it was a very worrying time. So it was kind of trying to just keep the ship afloat. And that was a very challenging time for me, in a sense, for my mother mostly, because she was the one worrying about feeding the family. And because my brother and my sister, my sister was 14 and my brother was 18. And so they were both still living at home. And she was kind of worrying about, you know, feeding them and keeping the house on their head when she had all of this debt now that was now her debt. And so a lot of decisions around selling assets and getting out of deals that Dad would have stayed in himself, but you needed to be a businessman to stay in them. And when you're a widow with kids, you're kind of, no, that's too risky. I'll just take the money and get out. So we got out of a lot of projects and a lot of businesses that in retrospect, you know, you might say was a mistake because they went on to become big businesses. But, you know, as I said before, you can't look back and with regret. You're best off just looking forward. And we did the best job at the time with what we could and the situation that we were in.
And obviously you've taken a lot of those traits of your father, because to have a real estate that has 8,000 people nearly working in it, just doesn't happen by chance, Gavin. You obviously have taken those traits and pushed them on and moved them on as well, and obviously it's working for you.
Well, I mean, to be fair, my dad and my grandfather, they had started the business, and it's a family business that I work in. And what I did go out on my own and start my own thing, and I did make something of myself doing my own thing, but the business part that I run now is part of a larger family business that wasn't started by me. So I can't take credit for that. Although I am working there for the last 20 years now as one of the main directors that kind of manage the business. But in terms of, I mean, I made a couple of mistakes myself. I mean, I got caught badly in the 2008 recession in my personal capacity. And I had kind of figured out that I was going to go off and do great things. And the timing was just so bad. And I ended up with banks chasing me and all sorts of stuff. So it wasn't all uphill, you know. There's a lot of ups and downs, in like a roller coaster in this business. And one of the reasons that I've started to kind of, I suppose, talk more about my background and stuff is because I see a lot of young entrepreneurs and property people. They're kind of ambitious about getting stuck into the business, and it is a good business, and if you enjoy this business, it's a great business. But it's a long term business, and it's one of these things that, you know, the decisions you make today and the actions you take today, they're going to be baked into the outcome 3 to 5 years from now. And so if you make a mistake today, you may not realize it for 3 to 5 years. But that's when you'll actually get the outcome of the decisions you're making today. So I'm trying to just get people to realize that it's a complex business and you do have to tread carefully, and it's cyclical. And that's the biggest thing about, you know, if you have that in your mind, you can have a couple of great years where the business is going up, 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 but it will stop, guaranteed, and it will start to fall again. And if you have bear that in mind, you might just be a little bit more cautious and not get yourself stuck at the top of the market buying in, because I made that mistake, and I just like to help people avoid those same mistakes.
And obviously that's something you're more passionate about, because you have you have a new podcast as well, and educating people. And is that something that wasn't out there whenever you were, I suppose, back in 2008, information? We see a lot of information, and good and bad information as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've been looking at, I've been on online for years, and I was always into tech, so I found, but the likes of the stuff that I'm talking about is all about the mental game behind property and real estate. And I don't see a huge amount of that going on out there. I see a lot of guys talking about all their success and a lot of, and puffing up their, you know, their successes and talking about how great it is. And if you just pay me XYZ, you can, you know, you can have this same success and give us your credit card. And I see so much of this, and I really want to kind of call it out, because I see there's a guy, I won't name him, but there's a guy over in the UK who sells these kind of high pressure kind of courses on property. And somebody went off, and I think he paid 6,000 or something like that, or 7,000 for access to this course, and like basically learned nothing and ended up taking his own life because he took that money that he needed and he put it into one of these courses. And that's kind of annoying me. And I kind of want to get out there and I want to kind of be the one who sets the record straight that this business, yes, you can make a lot of money, but you have to be very cautious and very, very careful. And you have to make decisions with a long term. You have to really know the business, not to get caught out. And so I'm trying to kind of teach those principles, and they're kind of universal principles. They're not specific to any particular market. They're more about, you know, understanding herd mentality and understanding when your ego is directing your decisions and when your emotions are kind of getting in the way of a kind of a pragmatic decision. And a lot of things like that, people just, they're not aware of it. And I certainly wasn't aware of it. And things like chasing the market down, when somebody offers you a price in a falling market and you turn your nose up at it because it seems insulting at the time, you can end up wishing you took that price. And I wish people had explained this to me back in 2008, because I was offered great prices for properties that I said, you know, go away out of here. That's a terrible price. But it's your ego playing tricks with you, saying, hold on a second, this was worth X just last year, and now I'm being offered this. You don't want to kind of accept and crystallize that lower price. And so you refuse to accept these offers. Sometimes they are the best offer you're going to get, and you're probably going to end up accepting something lower. So trying to get that across there, because I do think we're going to end up in a distressed market situation again. And I just think that if people maybe get some of this information now, rather than, you know, after the event and learning from their mistakes, like I had to, then should be.
I suppose it's not only property. You can adapt a lot of the mindset elements too. It's all business, you know.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. I've been listening to a guy that talks about the stock market and trading and investing and stuff. And a lot of the stuff he talks about is very similar. And it's, you know, there's a herd mentality. And it's, you know, if you want to be successful, you've got to think independently from the herd. And if you know about Warren Buffett in America, I mean, this guy just buys when everyone else is selling into the market, and he sells when everyone else is, you know, buying it. And it's that kind of mentality. It's being just the person who does not get affected by the emotion of it all, you know?
Talk to us about your business. And I had the pleasure of watching a presentation you made one night about different buildings that you've worked in and some of the exciting things. We've all the doom and gloom behind us. Now let's look at the positive element, but some of the details really stood out to me, that the technology of these buildings that are coming and the aspects that you'd be looking for. Let's talk a wee bit about that.
Well, I mean, what the big buzzword at the moment is prop tech. And it's a word that kind of, it's a combination of property technology. And prop tech is something that has kind of come into the world in about the last 4 years. I mean, it was around for many, many years. Different programs, like architects would use AutoCAD, which was a kind of prop tech, I guess you could say. But the reality is in the last few years, you've got sensors and you've got artificial intelligence and you've got blockchain and you've got all of this kind of crowdfunding, and all of these technologies are starting to converge on the real estate market. And, you know, you've if you watched what happened in the banking sector, you had, you know, the banks pretty much had the market to themselves. And all of a sudden you have these apps opening up on the phone where you can open a bank account very, very quickly. There's Revolut now on your mobile phone. You can pay bills with this Revolut, and you don't pay any, you know, money on exchanging money in the, you know, currency changing and stuff. So that all happened to the finance sector, but the real estate sector seemed to avoid it. And suddenly it's all coming now. And when I'm working on one of our tenants in East Point is a company called Oracle, and Oracle are a massive global sort of technology company. They're all over the world, and they recently finished their fitting out their building, and they put sensors everywhere. This whole building is completely wired to understand what's going on. And so when you walk in, the lights basically follow you, and they turn on wherever you are. They have sensors that are individual to the location where you are. And so if you walk into the toilet, it will light the cubicle that you're standing in, but it doesn't light the other ones. So it's good for the environment as well in terms of sustainability and stuff. But where really it's great about all this stuff is that it feeds back to this kind of information base that tells you what's happening in the building. What are the parts of the building that are the most interesting, the most, say, popular with the staff? And obviously that's not a problem at the moment, but I've just noticed that the more and more sort of younger people are getting interested in working for big companies who've got this technology, because you can find a desk using your phone. When you get into your car in the morning and you're driving into the office, you can tell the building that you're on the way, and it'll assign you a parking space while you're driving. And then when you get there, it tells you, okay, we know that you like the temperature to be so much and you don't like, say, direct sunlight. So we're going to put you on this side of the building where it's in the shade and you got a nice desk by the window. You know, you can have all of that now, and it's very dynamic. So I've been watching all of this, and it just fascinates me, and I'm trying to kind of stay on top of it. So I'm constantly looking out for the latest information on all this. And I do think it's going to really change the way we do business in the next couple of years. If you think about, if you've bought a house recently, you get your lawyer and you get your agent and you go and you do all of these things, and the process takes, you know, up to 10 or 12 weeks between seeing the property and eventually moving into it. That can be done in a couple of hours if you have the technology kind of configured for it. And even in Ukraine at the moment, they've actually introduced blockchain technology where you can buy an apartment using the internet now, and it takes no more than about half an hour, and you can own a property in the Ukraine. And that's something that's not possible here at the moment in this country, primarily because, you know, the law society would sort of have a problem with that, because I think an awful lot of lawyers probably would find themselves unable to deal with this, and it probably would actually cost quite a few lawyers their jobs and things like that. So there's going to be a lot of resistance naturally, but I do think if you see what's happened in the banking sector, like the likes of, if you go back to the 1980s and you see the New York Stock Exchange, all these millions of guys wearing different colored jackets, all screaming and shouting. If you go in there today, it's just a couple of computer screens. It's, you know, they don't need the guys screaming and shouting and running around. All they need is just a couple of computer terminals doing the exact same job. And that's where we're going with, I think, with the real estate business. I think it'll be highly automated. And even in construction terms, if you think about house building is pretty much hasn't changed in 100 years. I mean, you got the brickies and you got the guys out there pouring cement and all of that stuff. It looks very, very similar. There might be higher standards today with insulation and all that, but the actual physical construction is all carried out the same way with manual labor and stuff. And I can see in parts of the world now, like China and stuff, they've got robots that actually pour the walls and concrete. And there's 3D printing. You can actually 3D print a house now. And so all of this is really fascinating. And we're only kind of like at the very tip of the iceberg on this. I think there's going to be massive, massive change in the next decade.
Speaking of change over the years, Gavin, what changes have you done in your daily routine that you would feel that people should definitely look a wee bit more into?
I'll tell you my routine. Some people might think I'm a bit extreme. I get up at 5 every morning, and I come down, and what I do is I actually spend about a half an hour writing in a journal. And the idea behind that is to kind of register the various thoughts that I've had and the things that happened yesterday. And the idea that I have behind that activity is just to get a little bit of perspective on whether, rather than simply reacting all the time to inbound email and all of this kind of thing, I try to kind of write down my goals. I try to have a look at what my objectives are. And you do need to take that little bit of time out to make sure that you're going in the right direction. And I don't think if you just arrive at the office and open your computer and start typing away at the keyboard, you end up working on the agenda of whoever's email you're reading at the time. You're not necessarily working on your own. So that little action in the morning helps. And then something that I've introduced quite recently, and I was never really a believer in it until recently, is meditation. And if you asked me 10 years ago about meditation, I would have laughed, you know, but nowadays I realize the benefit. And it's similar to the journaling idea, is you have a, you just have this moment where you're thinking of nothing else but clearing your head of all thoughts and just sort of concentrating on maybe your breathing or something like that. And it's very difficult. We all have so much distraction these days. You've got your phone buzzing constantly, and there's, you know, whether it's Facebook or email or notifications or text messages, I think if you look at your phone, it will actually sometimes, different phones, they tell you how many times you picked up the phone during the day. And I look at it and it tells me I picked up the phone 170 times today, you know, and that's like every 3 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. And when you look at that, you realize, wow, the amount of distraction, and there's no quality of thought. So just spending 10 minutes or 15 minutes in the morning, just listening to your own breathing and just trying to eliminate all distraction and just focus, just those 10 minutes. And that really helps. And it strengthens that kind of focus muscle. And when I finish those two things, then I go and I do some exercise, and I usually try and do either a run or some interval training. And I just spend about an hour at that. And that kind of really regenerates me. And I feel kind of full of energy. The endorphins that kind of kick in after exercise are fabulous. So I'm kind of addicted to that. And then I start the day, and I just find that, you know, 2 hour sort of, I call it there's a different names for it. You see on the internet, but the miracle morning or the golden hour and all these kind of things, that's really what it is. And I've built that into my routine, and I, no matter if 7 days a week, I'll do that, because I have young kids and they're running around the house. And if I get up at the same time as them, I get none of that thinking time to myself. So first thing in the morning, down, have a cup of tea and do all of this kind of process.
And obviously you've seen improvements day on day, week on week.
The great thing about the journal is I can go back. I've actually got it in front of me here, and I can go back to, you know, the beginning of the year. And I've got, you know, the 28th of October, 2019, and I can read what was going on in my mind and stuff. And it gives you a little time out. And sometimes, you know, you're so caught up in the current urgency of whatever it is that you're working on, that you kind of take time out to kind of make sure that you're following the North Star. Because I'm a big believer in having kind of a long-term vision for where you kind of you're aiming for, and making sure that you're taking kind of daily steps in that direction. Because you'll find, you know, the years go by so fast that you look back and you go, wow, I can't believe 5 years has passed and I'm no closer to my goals than I was, you know. And if I go back and look at my journal 5 years ago, you can actually find, you know, goals that I had then that are still on it today. And I kind of wonder, like, why is that? Like, it's because I'm not focusing and I'm not prioritizing. So it's just a good habit, I think.
And then goals, obviously there's something that you really need to have when you're in business, but it's grand having goals, but it's the action part maybe that a lot of people get stuck with. And how do you get over that? Because as you said, you have a goal from 5 years ago and you still have it. So it must be in between the action part.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is like everybody else, I get caught up with, you know, procrastination is one of the big issues. And this is one of the reasons why I've introduced this meditation, because I find it's quite easy to get distracted by email and different things. And by having that little bit of meditation, what it allows me to do is to take kind of a very quick time out and just sort of, it's almost like you're kind of hovering above yourself, looking down and saying, are you sure you're working on the right thing right now? It gives you this, that time out that you need. And I found that by doing that, now I'm looking at my goals for the beginning of the year. And I've kind of made plans for, okay, this quarter I'm going to achieve the following. And I try to stick to those plans, and that should deliver on the bigger goals. But you've got to take action and you have to be pretty rigorous with yourself. And I try to be disciplined. I've stopped watching television and things like that because I just find it's, you know, the things like the news, for example, whether it doesn't matter what news you watch, it's always got some kind of negative headline, and it's got, it kind of creates this sense of concern I just find people have anxiety. For example, COVID-19, I mean, it's been a worrying period for time. We all know that we have problems ahead. We have, you know, a lot of people have lost their jobs and a lot of people are, you know, struggling with their business and stuff. You don't need to look at the news to know that you've got a difficult time. But when you look at the news, you hear about, oh, so many extra 100,000 people are now unemployed and so many extra businesses are feeling the pinch. And I kind of, it reinforces an awful lot of negative thought. And so I've removed myself from all that. And I kind of think the one thing that I'm concerned with is the stuff that I can actually directly control myself. So it's the decisions I make. Are they good decisions? Have I got a good process in place? And then taking action around those decisions and not let myself get, you know, distracted or get caught up in the herd mentality where, you know, if I look at the 6 o'clock news this evening and I heard that there's some panic sort of buying or panic selling or something, you start getting anxiety around these things. And instead, I just focus on what my objectives are and I try to kind of make sure I deliver on those.
And can we delve into those goals? Can we hear what one of them might be, or what's in the pipeline, maybe, Gavin, that you might be able to?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a range of different ones. I kind of have a kind of you know, different areas of life that I try to maintain, and I have, you know, so fitness is one of them, and I'm constantly trying to kind of striving for to be fitter and healthier. And so I've got a lot of goals in that specific area, and some of them are specific challenges that I set myself. Back in the beginning of the year, I set myself the challenge of doing 1,000 burpees for charity, and I pulled it off, and I managed to do it, and it took me 2.5 hours. And the thing is like, if you don't set these stretch goals, it's, you know, you end up kind of just living a kind of a mediocre kind of existence. And so I try to do stuff that's kind of pushing myself way outside of my comfort zone. So then the next thing that I decided that I wanted, one of my goals was to do public speaking. And I wasn't doing any kind of public speaking last year. And then I decided, okay, that's something that I'm going to do a lot more of this year. And so I started practicing. I joined Toastmasters, and now here I am talking to you because of those actions. I found myself doing an awful lot more talking on radio and podcasts and various things like that. So it's, you know, those are two of my goals. And the purpose of that was that I felt that I had this experience from the 2008 crash, and I kind of feel like I can help some people. There's actually been some, some tragedy in our family. Two of my close relatives took their own lives over the last sort of 20 years. And I saw the impact it has on the family. And I kind of thought to myself, this, I know from 2008, I know from the, you know, the impact that a lot of people actually made that kind of terminal decision. And I kind of think to myself that maybe my experience and my outlook and the way I kind of stay positive and the resilience that I've developed and the strategies around that about, you know, the meditation, the journal and keeping fit, all of that hopefully will help people understand that even if you're in a really, really difficult situation right now, you will get out of it. What you have to kind of remember is tough times don't last, but tough people do. And so you just develop that kind of resilient mindset and just realize that, look, it's only temporary. It's just, you got to bite your lip and dig in for a couple of months or years, a year or two, whatever it is. And then you'll come out the other end and you'll be stronger for it. And so my goal around that, I've obviously got business goals. We're trying to grow our business now in this distressed time. We've actually positioned ourselves quite well. We got caught in 2008 with a lot of different debts. So what we did is over the last few years, we've actually been paying down debt and we've been getting ourselves into a position that we could actually take advantage of a downturn. So we're actually in quite a healthy position relative to a lot of people that, and relative to how we were in 2008, when, I mean, the market collapsed and prices dropped by, you know, 50%, 60%. And when you're in that position, if you don't have, you don't have reserves sitting ready to go, you can't take advantage of any of the low prices. And then you end up watching all these kind of, we've seen them all, the big foreign investment funds coming in and buying up half the country for pennies on the pound. And so we're hoping that this time around we'll be in a much better position.
That time back in 2008, Gavin, the boardroom meetings, obviously they weren't easy things to have at that stage, but going into to what the unknown is now, where we're at, and you have dipped your toe into it, you've explained you're better prepared, and obviously you're going to take advantage of it. But maybe take me back to that time as well, because I think there's a lot of learning out of that for people. You touched on it there very well, from the point of view of your mindset and getting your body right first of all, and then moving it into your business, and then obviously after, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock and even pulling yourself out of that business and having that time for yourself. But let's go back to that time. Let's go back to the real heavy lifting of 2008, because everybody was in it.
Yeah, I was in a really tough position, because what I had actually done in 2006, I made all the mistakes that you can imagine. One of the things that I kind of tried to tell young people who are kind of coming into this business or just people who want to be investors is that the worst teacher you'll ever have is success, and the best teacher is failure. And nobody wants to fail, but it's only the lessons that you get, the best lessons are from the failures, never from the success. And in 2006, I'd been very active from around about 2002. And in that 4-year period, there was just, everything was going right. And every deal that I made turned into gold. And I mean, some deals were really, really cracking deals. And I made a lot of money very, very quickly. And worst mistake in a sense is to make that kind of money easily, because when you're starting out and you're learning all these things, that kind of success goes to your head. You start getting it into your head that you everything you touch is going to turn to gold, and you're never going to make a mistake. So I bought a load of different projects. I started projects. I actually bought a property in Spain. And I decided that I was going to do this huge, ambitious project in the south of Spain. And I upped sticks and I actually moved to Spain just before the crisis began. And just as I was signing the contract on this huge, big property deal, Lehman Brothers collapsed. And was carrying millions in debt, and I had about 25 or 26 investors that had put money into this project. I mean, it was just a complete disaster. And so I was firefighting straight away. And I mean, every decision you had to make was an extremely difficult decision. And, you know, you had to go through pay cuts. I had to let people go, people that you didn't want to let go that were valuable to you, having to kind of, you know, you can't afford their salary anymore. The worst thing was having to sell my home. I had moved to Spain, but I had kept on to my nice home in Dublin. And so I had the two properties, and I figured, you know, I would eventually come back to Dublin. So I wanted to hang on to the house. And the problem was that when this all happened, the bank started coming after me looking for money and things. And I had to decide on either I'm going to sell the house in Spain or I'm going to sell the house in Ireland. And the house in Ireland was the one that had to go because I was right in the middle of this big Spanish project. And so I let the house go at an absolute, you know, bargain of a price. And I just couldn't believe, I think I sold the house for about 25% of the value it had been in 2006. And just the pain of having to accept this beautiful home that you built yourself and having to sell it for that kind of money, all because of the decisions I had made from 2006. So in that 4-year period, I made all this money. And in that 2-year period, I'd made all these ridiculous kind of investments, didn't think about where I was, and ended up kind of paying a huge price. And it took me years to kind of dig myself out of that. So, you know, banks are very difficult people to deal with because they bring in a team every couple of months and they switch it up. So I had relationships when the market was going great. I had relationships with all these different managers in the bank, and I would send them a big hamper full of wine at Christmas time and all of these things. And they'd be calling me up, "Oh, Gatland, do you need any more money?" and all this. And then when, you know, it's like when it's sunny, they're giving you the umbrella. And then the moment there's a few drops of rain, "Give us back that umbrella." And and so I found myself in a situation where all of the people I had these great relationships with that were, you know, that really knew me and understood me and stuff, they were suddenly no longer my relationship managers. They were all gone. It was completely new set of faces. And so you're dealing with someone who's you've never met before. So you've got no rapport with them. You've got no idea, is this guy going to be reasonable? Is he going to be difficult? So you spend a couple of months getting to know them, to dealing with them, and you're there's a lot of back and forth. And then all of a sudden, just when you're starting to get the rapport with the guy, bang, it's a whole new team again. And that was probably one of the worst things, because every single time the person had to get to know you again and learn about who you are and see, you know, are you a person that has, you know, this integrity, and if you say you're going to do something, you're going to do it, or are you kind of a messer who says something and then does the opposite? And the problem is the banks were dealing with so many delinquent loans that they probably had the whole ramet. And, you know, you were constantly on the back foot. So that was a really difficult time. And I can remember I had one at one stage. I got this email, and I had income coming in from the different rental properties that were there. And I suddenly got this email from the bank saying that they had decided that they were implementing what they called a full cash sweep. And that meant that every single penny that I earned through the rental properties just disappeared straight into the bank, and I never went near my bank account. So I actually, suddenly all of my income was dried up just like that. So those are the kind of decisions. And then they impact the mindset and everything. So the resilience I talk about, it's real. You know, you really do need to have a very, very solid mindset going into this. Especially now that if you're going into difficult times, and I do think we are going to go into difficult times. I don't think you can have the numbers of people that have been made unemployed and the number of businesses that have shut down. I'm hearing things like that 30% of the pubs in the country will not reopen at all. And, you know, that kind of impact to the economy, you're just not going to just bounce back from that. And on all of the stimulus that they're talking about, you know, the government will pay us, you know, COVID payments and all that. Well, who's going to pay all that? That's also going to have to be paid for, either by higher, you know, taxes or something. So it's going to be a difficult couple of years. And I think you've got to prepare for that mentally. And you got to kind of think of yourself as going into a boxing match or something. And are you ready for it? And, you know, the old saying, you know, you everyone's got a plan until they're hit in the face. and it's a bit like that, you know, doesn't matter what your plans were, they're now out the window and you got to get ready just to kind of deal with what comes towards you.
But obviously as a country, we are still in a position where we can come out of it, like we did back in 2000.
I think we're probably stronger than most, to be honest. I think, you know, the fact that we bounced back out of, you know, the 2008 crisis the way we did, I mean, I'm immensely proud as a country how we've handled the COVID-19 situation. I think it's been handled really well. You look at America and the complete debacle that's going on there, and the way it's being handled, I think we've done very well. And so I do think if you know, sounder heads prevail and we manage this very strongly as well. But it's going to be difficult because, you know, the amount of borrowing and stuff that we're going to have to do to fund all of this is going to be pretty high. So I wouldn't be surprised if an element of, I won't say that the dreaded word austerity comes back, but I definitely think there's going to have to be some belt tightening. And, you know, you have to be prepared for that, I think.
Big data is the buzzword. A lot of properties and businesses is happening throughout Ireland due to big data. Some people don't understand it, myself maybe included, but it generates a lot of jobs. And when you look like some of your customers, Google, for example, and Facebook and LinkedIn, and really Ireland punches above its weight. I know there's a lot made of it come to Ireland for the tax breaks and things like that, but you need to have, obviously, the workforce here, and that's something that we really do have. And maybe you can elaborate a bit more on that, Gavin.
Well, yeah, no, I think that the country is massively punching above its weight. If you think about, I mean, just look at all the different metrics for Ireland. Ireland, the agriculture sector alone feeds 50 million people. You know, we have a population of 5. Our agriculture sector feeds 50 million people. And I mean, that's staggering compared to some countries around the world. Our pharmaceutical sector, I think 10 of the 12 largest pharmaceutical companies in the world are based here in Ireland. And if you look at then the tech sector, you know, probably 90% of all the technology companies in the world are based here in Ireland. And, you know, I can just keep on, you know, talking about all these amazing facts and figures. It's just, we really do punch way above. And I don't put it all down to the tax breaks. I think it's very short-sighted to look at that, because people can go off to the Middle East and, you know, I spent some time in Dubai and Qatar and places. Qatar has got so much money because of their gas reserves. If they wanted, you know, to drop the tax rate to zero, they could afford to do that. But you're not going to have massive companies moving there because the workforce is not there, you know. And the workforce is here in Ireland. We have a culture. I lived in the Middle East for 3 years, and we have a culture here that, you know, we have our football clubs and our rugby clubs, and you can have a life here. Whereas I found when I was there in Dubai that it's a kind of a stop off. It's not the sense of building a life there. It's kind of, I'll spend a couple of years here, I'll make some money, and then I'll go back to, you know, where I'm from or whatever. And that's one of the things that I think Ireland really has going. It has a culture that, you know, people come here and they stay to live the rest of their lives. And I think young people, the education system is really, really a high standard. And I've got some kids, some teenage kids that are doing well. One of them just managed to sidestep her junior cert, and she's very pleased about that. But I think it's one of those things. It's like, if you look at the quality of our education system, it's pretty high standard, and I look at what they're learning and stuff, and if you compare that to some countries around the world, I mean, our education system is just head and shoulders above the rest, and that's something I'm again quite proud of as a country. And I do think that if you look at our business park, we've got Oracle and Google, and we have Enterprise Ireland, and about 50 different companies are based in our business park. And some of the larger ones like Oracle, I don't know exactly how many they employ, but it's in the region of 3,000 people in our park alone. And then Google probably 2,000. And I mean, that's a big number of staff. And the reason it is that they're there is not just tax. It's, you know, these are smart people. They're from all over the world. You know, there's the amount of languages that are spoken in the queue when I'm standing in the sandwich queue in the newsagents downstairs and from my office. I'm standing there and I can hear Portuguese, Russian, you know, I can hear Hebrew sometimes. And I mean, just literally every French, German, it's just every language, every different nationality is working there in these big international companies. And so it's pretty fascinating. And there's mostly young people in their kind of 20s to 30s that I see. And so it's pretty encouraging. And I don't see them all. I mean, there will be some job losses, but young people can kind of bounce back, which is a good thing because they're adaptable. And nowadays, as well as that, this comes back to my kind of entrepreneurial sort of bent, is just the fact that now the opportunities that we have available to us today are incredible. I mean, just, you know, the mobile phone, what is possible from your mobile phone? You know, you can raise money, you can broadcast yourself, you can attract customers, you can, you know, get leads for your business. It's all doable on your phone. In the past, you had to go off and you had to hire an office and you had to get phone. Back in the 80s, it took 2 or 3 months to get a phone put into your office. I mean, that was the kind of business that, you know, the time lag that was involved. Back in the 80s, to fly to London cost £500. This is in the 80s. That's like paying £5,000 today, you know. You can go on Ryanair to London for, you know, €29 or something like that. It's the opportunities that we have nowadays are just massive. They're limitless. And we really have to kind of get that mindset into our head. And then big data, you mentioned, like, technology is transforming the world and it's going to present massive opportunities. And the one thing that I would say is anyone who is stuck in a kind of an analog way of doing business, And you've got the old timers who kind of say, I know how to do it. That's how it's going to be. Those guys need to watch their backs. The new way of doing business is creeping up on us all. And I do think that this COVID-19 lockdown we've all gone through is basically I'm calling it the world's greatest work from home experiment, because millions of people around the world worked from home for the last 7 weeks.
And that's a question I was going to put to you, and it's probably going against the grain, obviously, with your commercial element. But do you see it also a carrot for companies to come to Ireland, and people obviously can work in rural Ireland because the broadband speed is quite good, and it's just an extra really good incentive that they're not sitting probably in traffic and
I think there's a couple of comments. First of all, I'm not sure the broadband is good for everybody. And that's one of the issues. My sister lives here in Dublin, but she lives kind of up in the foothills of the Dublin mountains, and she doesn't have broadband. So she's unable to work from home. And my brother-in-law, her husband, he's had to drive down from the house and drive down to my mother's house and park his car in her driveway, because she's in isolation herself, so he's not allowed into the house. But he sits in the car and uses the Wi-Fi from the house to do his business. And, I mean, that is kind of ridiculous in Dublin. So, I mean, you know, I don't have experience in Donegal or wherever, you know, different people are from. Yeah. But definitely, you know, if you've got great broadband, then it's a massive benefit. I have seen my own broadband here in Dublin has come under a bit of strain from the amount of usage, and it's slowed down a bit, but it's good. Yeah, it makes a big difference. Now, the next thing I would say, so working from home, I think, is here to stay, but I don't think it's the end of the office. I have seen a lot of articles in the news about the end of the office and all this. I do think there's an element of truth to that, but the office is not going to go away. And the reason I believe that is that company culture is very much formed in the office. And I think particularly young people like to go to the office for the banter and the kind of the crack and meeting their friend, you know, their workmates after work and things like that. If you're working from home, it's quite an isolating kind of experience. And one of the reasons that you know, the business WeWork, one of the reasons that they came out of the 2008 recession so fast, like they started in 2010, I think it was. And what actually happened was so many people had been laid off. They were working from home. They were starting their own business. They were doing this and they felt this isolation and they wanted to go somewhere to work together where they could meet other people and they could kind of get together. And what you used to do was you used to bring your laptop to Starbucks and you'd sit in the window drinking your Frappuccino or whatever, and you'd be working away. And that would be your sense of getting out of the house and getting away from the isolation. But all of a sudden people created these co-working places and you could go in and not just were you now mingling with other people, but you could meet somebody who had complementary service that you can add to your business, or who would know a client who he can recommend you to. And suddenly it kind of created this. So I don't think people are going to work from home in isolation. I do think it will be a combination of going into the office maybe 2 days a week or 3 days a week or whatever it is. Obviously, if they find a vaccine for this COVID-19, then you know a lot of stuff could go back. But I do think this work from home experiment has been pretty successful, and because of that, I don't think people are just going to abandon it. I think there is a lot of benefits to it. I think work life balance and things like that have improved. My commute is one third of what it normally is, and I don't want everyone going back to work and making me have to drive an extra 40 minutes every day.
Look, Em, we've been chatting for an hour, so it's just flown by, and it's been brilliant. And you've been so insightful with your information. But I'm going to give you some questions that I've asked some of our listeners to ask you.
Sure.
I suppose, what one asset or skill would you advise people to look into?
Are you just talking about general across the board?
Just general across the board, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, this might seem a bit silly now, but my daughter is learning to type, five-finger typing. And she's in school learning this. And it's actually a skill that I think we should all have developed at a very young age, because every one of us now is using a keyboard for pretty much all of our work. And if you're there with, the two-finger typing, I was working with a PA friend, a colleague years ago, and she was able to type 90 words a minute and she never had to look at the keyboard. And I can remember, and I think that is a skill that is just, it's insanely valuable nowadays with the amount of email we have and just the ability to kind of knock through your email very, very quickly. I do think delegation is a skill that will give you superpowers in business. And so if you, depending on your outlook on what you want to do in business and stuff, but we all suffer from being very good at a certain thing and not liking other things. And delegation is a skill that you have to learn pretty quick when you start out on your own. And if you don't learn to delegate and you're always trying to hog the work, you'll never really grow your business. You'll always be kind of stuck, kind of the one who has to do this and has to do that. And oftentimes I have a good friend who he had his own business and he was also into parachuting and base jumping and things like, this kind of extreme sports stuff. And he had a bad accident. His parachute failed to open and he hit the ground from about 30 feet up, and he broke both his ankles and his knees and did all this kind of terrible damage. And he was told he'd never walk again. So he's in hospital bed for months and months. And his business is martial arts. And so he's now out of it. He was the coach that did all of the training and everything. And suddenly, you know, he's finished. And he thought maybe he'll never walk again. Well, how's he going to? And he learned to delegate, and he managed to identify coaches that would actually replace him. And he's actually, his business is now 10 times the size it was when he started out himself as the guy in the driving seat. And it was all because he was forced to learn to delegate. So that's a real skill. And then I would think that if you haven't done it before, and a lot of people have a fear of it, public speaking. So many people I know are really, really fearful of it. And I understand that sort of sense of anxiety around it. So I would ask people to consider joining a Toastmasters club. There's so many of them around. They're literally everywhere. If you look into it, you'll probably find there's one only a few miles from your home. And the reality is you go and you meet up on a regular enough basis, and you get an opportunity to speak in a small gathering of people that you get to know. They become your friends, and it just teaches you to get that anxiety off your chest. And now I've benefited from it greatly, and I have no problem now doing any kind of public speaking. And it helps you with your confidence then presenting in business, and there's all these knock-on benefits to it. So that's another skill, I would think.
What's the best advice you ever received?
That's a good question. Let me think. That goes back to, I'll tell you, probably the best mentor that I ever had was when I started working in the architect's office, Scott Tallon Walker. I worked with a guy called Eugene McLernan, and Eugene was just this really sort of active guy, but he was he was just a great guy to work for. And he finished work at 5:30 every single day. Didn't matter what, at 5:30, pens down, everybody, you can go home now. And that was some great advice, is just know when to finish your job, like get your work done in a focused kind of condensed way, you know, put everything into your work during the day. But then at 5:30, bang, down tools and go home and leave it till the morning. And the next morning he'd be in first thing in the morning. So he was an early bird, and he kind of taught me, him and a guy called Brian Foley, the two of them taught me this, get up early, get in, get it all sort of started early. And it stuck with me. And I think it's been massively productive and helpful for me in my life. And I mean, there's been so many bits of advice over the years, but those are the two that stand out.
And we'll leave the best question to last. What was the worst, worst bit of advice you got?
I'll tell you the worst bit of advice, not that I got, but the worst bit of advice that myself and a friend, a business partner, we said the words to one another that this deal was a no-brainer, okay? And that turned into, we both decided, you know, about a year later, we were saying, did we call this deal a no-brainer? And we both agreed that if we ever uttered the words no-brainer again, we were allowed to clatter each other over the back of the head. And what happened was a deal came along, and it looked like a no-brainer. And we both decided, wow, let's just get into this deal. We didn't look around. We didn't do all of this kind of due diligence, and we just piled into this deal, and we borrowed a load of money, and we thought that it was all lined up and it was all going to happen like clockwork. And suddenly a planning permission went from the shop next door. Another planning permission went in, and our tenant that we thought was a no-brainer just decided, that's it, I'm pulling out of the job, pulling out of the project straight away. And we spent the next 5 years trying to find a tenant for that building, and we could not find a single tenant. And we eventually found somebody who opened like a fast food restaurant, and no sooner had they opened, there was the local thugs started coming around looking for protection money and all this kind of stuff. And so they closed the business, and we were there like, God, this is just, and we ended up selling the property in an Allsops auction, and we sold it for 1/5 of what we paid for it. Oh. And that was the no-brainer. So never let anyone tell you a deal is a no-brainer.
Gavin, it's been great. Thanks very much for your time. Where can people find out more about you and get on your podcast as well?
Well, my podcast is called Behind the Facade, and you'll find it where you find all podcasts in Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And if you want to find out more about me, my handle that I go by for pretty much everything is Gavin J. Gallagher. So J for James, my grandfather. GavinJGallagher.com is my blog and my website, and you'll find various links to different things there. So if anyone has any questions or wants any advice, shoot me over there a message or find me on social, and I'd be delighted to engage.
That's all from today's Breadwinners Business Podcast. Many thanks for all the downloads during the week. Don't forget, we have 10 hours of free business mentoring for any of our listeners available with Joe Doyle. Just pop over to our Facebook page and message me your email address. I hope today's podcast was useful. Please tag me over on our Facebook page. But from myself, Pádraig Hilfirthy, and the Breadwinner Podcast team, we look forward to speaking to you next week. This business podcast is brought to you in association with GapPropertyInvestments.com.